This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscowane. With the unofficial start of summer just a few days away, many of us are planning Memorial Day food and perhaps trying to shake it up a bit with new recipes and fresh ingredients. We're not knocking hamburgers and hot dogs, of course, but today we flip the menu a bit with a barbecue expert. Joe Carroll is chef and owner of Fetisau Restaurant. He's also author of Feeding the Fire, Recipes and Strategies for Better Barbecue and Grill. Hi, Joe.
Yes.
Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you.
And Joshua Lawler is the chef owner of Farm and the Fisherman, a restaurant which focuses on locally produced vegetables, meats, and cheeses. He is a fisherman, and he'll tell us what's in season, where to find it, and how to prepare it. Hi, Josh.
Hello. Thanks for having me today.
Sure. So if you're a real fan of fresh food, this is just a great time of the year. In the Philadelphia region, asparagus is here, strawberries are starting to come in. Josh, what else are you as a chef looking forward to?
I just really enjoy the whole bounty of the season. I'm a big proponent of the farmers markets. I spend a lot of time there and really just talking to farmers, and as well as the variety of produce that kind of starts right now, and also heading to the summer, corn and tomatoes and all that great stuff.
Yeah, so the basics. Joe Carroll, you say one of the most important lessons in barbecue is that great results demand the best quality meat. And both you and Josh are believers in working with local farms, right, Joe?
Absolutely. No question.
So tell us a little bit more about your relationship with small family-run farms. Let's start there.
Well, so I'd like to say, first of all, one of the things that is even more important than working with a really small family farm, though that is very important for us, is working with any farm that's, well, first of all, not a giant factory farm, but that raises their animals in a really natural way. And that's really important. And it just so happens that small family farms almost always tend to do that because they have smaller herds and they really tend to them in a real individual way. We work with a lot of different small family farms throughout the country, predominantly on the East Coast relatively near us. We work with a group called Fossil Farms out of New Jersey, and they're sort of a broker for a lot of New Jersey family farms. And then we work with Northeast Family Farmers, which are all based around the Finger Lakes up in New York State, and also, again, they sort of work as a broker. See, a lot of these small family farms, because they have such small herds, it's very difficult for them, unless they have, you know, one or two very tight relationships with a chef or a restaurant, a lot of times they need somebody, sort of a middleman, to help them bring their product to the table. And also, you know, there's usually not enough product from one individual small family farm to supply many restaurants. So that's why these brokers kind of gather product from many small family farms.
So, but this product is worth it, and how?
No question.
Describe how.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that family farmers tend to do is not use commercial breeds. They tend, especially in the last 10, 20 years, to use heritage breed animals, much older breeds that were around before commercial farming and factory farming, became a thing. And factory farming, you know, needs speed. It needs to bring the animals to slaughter very quickly. And the breeds have been in place now to do that, to fatten up quickly and to you know, come to market very, very fast. The other thing when it comes to pork is a lot of these commercial breeds, a lot of the fat and the intensity of flavor has been bred out of the commercial breeds. So when you start using heritage breed pigs, the flavor and the aroma of the pig is just so much more intense than what you would ever get at your average supermarket.
Joshua Lawler, so your thoughts on working with local farms, why do you do it?
I find most of my inspiration comes from just seeing the product and kind of have a connection with the farmer, and getting things at the peak of the season I think is really important, and also just a sense of seasonality in eating. I think it's important to eat what's in season. It kind of makes you appreciate things more when you can only get them at certain times of the year and you're eating them at their peak. They're the freshest and they tend to be grown with the most care by small artisanal producers.
And as we mentioned before, and as the name of your restaurant suggests, you are a fisherman. So where do you fish and what's in season now?
Right now, we're just kind of getting off as far as Northeast fishing goes. I fish a lot out of Cape May. I like to do a lot of jetty fishing and beach fishing.
And are you fishing for your restaurant or just for yourself?
Just for myself. I actually release mostly everything I catch. It's not a very good, as far as chef goes, I kind of release a lot. Right now, bluefish are really abundant right now on the East Coast. We serve those at the restaurant. They're getting fish right now from like New Jersey up until to Long Island area.
Mm-hmm.
Just really an underappreciated fish that we love to serve and kind of showcase it and show people that it's, while it's underappreciated, it can be, you know, really delicious meal.
So is it underappreciated because it has a rather pungent flavor?
I think it's underappreciated. It's sort of like Brussels sprouts. It's, you know, it's something that if you don't cook it right, it's not going to come out tasting great. And I think that's how most people have had it the first few times.
So what's the key to cooking bluefish correctly?
Bluefish is the key is to get rid of as much of the darker tissue as possible. And then it's also to cook it as gently as possible. So the minute you take a really oily fish and if you really overcook it and sear it really hard, you're going to accentuate that flavor of high oil content of the fish. Whereas if you do it slowly and gently, you'll kind of mellow it out a little bit and you get that rich oiliness in the flesh, but without that intense fish flavor that kind of puts people off.
Well, we're talking about grilling as well since the weekend's coming out and coming up, and I guess a lot of folks are getting their grills together. What's the key to grilling fish?
So grilling anything is kind of, I think the secret is a really hot grill to start. Starting off on a really hot grill with your fish and putting your fish on and then just like not touching it for a little while and letting that crust develop from the grill to the fish, letting it get a really nice sear, and then kind of lowering the heat. And that'll let your fish not stick and it'll gently cook it and it'll be moist and kind of, you know, delicate.
Do all fishes translate to the grill? What doesn't work?
What doesn't work, I guess, is stuff that would be super flaky, like cod might not work so well, only because it tends to kind of fall apart the minute it starts to cook. So I would stick to a little bit denser fish. And if it's like a lighter, flakier fish, I would kind of put it in foil and then put it on the grill.
And Joe, you grill fish, but
sure.
you don't scale the fish, correct? The skin is on?
Yes, we scale it, but we leave the skin on, yes, most of the time.
And so why do you do that?
Well, I think the skin actually helps protect the fish a bit, but it also adds a lot of flavor, and the skin's really good for you. I love the taste of, like, crispy, charred skin. I think it adds a lot to the, you know, overall dish. Some skin isn't really the greatest, but most are. Most really work really well.
Probably an acquired taste for the American palate, or do you find that your clients enjoy it?
No, I find that most of them enjoy it. I mean, I think some, if they're not used to it, they just avoid it, But I think in New York City we have pretty adventurous eaters, so people rarely have issue with that.
And the key to successful grilling with most foods is using oil to clean the grill, oil for the actual food. Joe, why don't you get into that a little bit for us?
Yeah, I mean, this is especially true when grilling something like fish, something that, you know, can stick to the grill very easily. So a well-seasoned grill will really help avoid that. And also, just not touching the fish, as you were saying, really backing off and having the discipline to not mess with it for a little bit until a nice little crust develops. But having a well-seasoned grill will go such a long way in not allowing the food to stick to that grill.
Well, first, cleaning the grill, you use oil, correct?
Yeah, I'll usually go over it once with something coarse to get any like harder things off, and then again with some oil to get some of the fine, more powdery, ashen kind of, you know, particulates off the grill, so that it doesn't discolor anything you put on there. And then if I'm grilling anything that I know can stick, I'll go back over that grill every couple of minutes, maybe 3 to 10 times or more. Certainly, if it's something like a fish that can stick very easily, I'll go, you know, easily 10 times. Over that grill with some oil and, you know, give it a minute in between each time and create a nice, you know, almost like a non-stick surface on that grill.
And what type of oil do you use?
You know, any oil will really work. Vegetable oil is kind of the best because it does good with high heat and it won't really produce any off flavors. But, you know, in a pinch, olive oil or something else like that can work, too.
And let's define our terminology here, too. Folks tend to use barbecue and grilling interchangeably, but there is a difference, right?
Yeah, no question. You know, in the north and really most parts of the country, unless you're from, you know, down south, barbecue and grilling are interchangeable. And I think even down south, the term barbecue can mean both the act of barbecuing something, but also, you know, an event that you go to, you know, some sort of social gathering. And I think more often that's what we refer to it here as well in the Northeast. You know, we're going to a barbecue, but we're actually grilling. But when it comes down to the techniques, they are radically different. Not even close. They both happen to take place in similar settings, you know, outdoors usually, and with lots of people hanging around in a party kind of atmosphere quite often. But technique-wise, they're at opposite ends of the spectrum. One is very high heat, very quick cooking, very lean pieces of protein, and the other is very low heat, very slow cooking, and very fatty pieces of protein.
And we'll get into more of that in just a bit. But before we get to the break, I did want to get back to the grilled fish before we kind of finish up with the fish. What do you like, Josh, to use to dress your fish? Do you have any favorite ingredients, something really simple that you can pass along to our listeners?
As far as finishing or kind of like a dry, like a seasoning?
While you're grilling the fish, before you put it on there, what do you season it with?
Before I really do like a – I like two things, and I kind of get made fun of at the restaurant because he's one of everything's, but I use fennel pollen in a lot of things.
Fennel pollen.
And it's really just like the pollen off the fennel plant.
Sure.
And you buy it dried, and it just gives this like really delicate, beautiful fennel flavor that's kind of mellow.
You just sprinkle it lightly, or you
just
rub
it? Just kind of sprinkle it like you would pepper.
Okay.
And then I use Espelette pepper, which is a like a red pepper that's kind of ground. It does have like a little bit of smokiness to it and a little bit of heat, but not much. And I pretty much almost season everything with like fresh herbs, then fennel pollen and Espelette and a little salt and pepper.
And that works for any fish?
It works for any fish or like light meat, like chicken, stuff like that.
And then when you pull the fish off the grill, do you dress it afterwards?
So when I pull the fish off, it tends to be like a little dry. I'll hit it with a really good olive oil, a good finishing olive oil, like a nice bright green olive oil. And then I'll hit it with some citrus, whether it's lemon or lime or like half of an orange.
Joe, any thoughts from you?
Josh and I are on the exact same page. I mean, that's exactly what I would do. You know, olive oil, salt, lemon juice. You cannot go wrong. If you have a great piece of fish and you just add those three ingredients and nothing more, it's going to taste fantastic. Certainly a little fennel pollen will make it even that much better. But, those three ingredients and, you know, maybe a little garlic butter if it's, something that you want to go in a slightly different direction. But keeping it simple, I think, always works best, particularly on the grill.
Summer's wonderful, isn't it? Hey, a quick question before we go to the break. Where do you find fennel pollen?
Fennel pollen? Well, I mean, if you go on Amazon and hit fennel pollen, you can get like a nice bag of fennel pollen, and it's pretty.
And is it at the grocery store and I'm just not seeing it?
It might be at like a finer grocery store. I mean, in a pinch, you could just take fennel seeds and grind them to like a finer dust and you'll get the same effect.
Okay, we're delving into the summer menu here today on Radio Times. Josh Lawler is chef owner of Farm and the Fisherman, and Joe Carroll is chef and owner of Fetisau Restaurant. Lines are open if you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about summer foods, how to prepare them. Joe Carroll is chef and owner of Fetisau Restaurant, and Josh Lawler is chef owner of Farm and the Fisherman. And as always, we love to hear from you, 888-477-9499. If you'd like to send us an email, by all means do so, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Okay, so back to barbecue. Joe, you say barbecue is a technique, not a recipe.
Absolutely.
So to do it properly, do you need to buy a smoker?
No, not at all. Certainly not, a dedicated smoker. You can use your grill. You just have to set it up differently. You have to set it up for smoking, not for grilling. But you can use a grill, even a gas grill. It's not ideal, but it'll certainly work.
Well, how do you set up a grill for smoking?
Well, I would put all of the heat on one side of the grill, and I would put the meat on the other, and I would make the temperature low. And if there is vents on your grill, I would put one vent under the fire and one vent over the meat, and that basically will work as a smoker, just like that. Obviously, you're going to need to put some sort of wood on top of the fire as well.
And you say wood is an ingredient.
Yeah, well, it's really a seasoning, and oddly enough, that's exactly how most city health departments view it too. If you're not cooking exclusively with it, they view it as a seasoning, and it truly is, because that's what it's doing to the meat. You can use any source of fuel to cook, but wood definitely adds a particular flavor and aroma to what it is you're cooking. When you use hard wood, and various hard woods have different flavors and aromas that develop as you burn them, when you use that hard wood, it imparts that flavor and aroma to the meat or vegetables or whatever it is you're cooking.
I was reading, of course, mesquite and hickory, but then also almond, sarsaparilla, and pimento?
Yeah, really any hard wood. Now, certain hard woods, such as mesquite, for example, you need to be a little careful with, because they can be intensely flavored. So if you've never worked with them before, I would say start very lightly. Oak is really the best all-around wood to use, red or white oak, it doesn't really matter. It creates a nice smoke flavor and aroma. It's not too intense, but it's not super light like a lot of fruit woods could be. And it burns at a nice temperature, too. Some fruit woods can burn a little hot.
Josh, do you like to work with woods?
I love to smoke things at the restaurant, but actually at home I almost use exclusively gas grill, which I know is, not the best thing for a chef to say, but it's just for me. I have three kids, and we like to eat kind of quick or easy, and I use a gas grill a lot at home, and just for me it's like simple and quick.
Well, that's an important part of the conversation, because so many of us are running hard. Mm-hmm. We barely have time to prepare food. The great thing about summer, obviously, is there's so much fresh stuff out there. It really needs very little. It doesn't need to be overprepared to taste good. Mm-hmm. So yeah, let's definitely bring that into the conversation. And by the way, are the kids cooking right alongside you at home?
They do. They love to cook, especially my twin boys.
Let's get to side dishes, vegetables. Which work best on the grill, Josh, in your opinion?
I mean, a lot of meals at my house in the summer are just based around like a really good loaf of bread and then maybe like a little bit of meat that I might have brought home from the restaurant, and then a lot of vegetables on the grill. Either quickly grilled and then pulled off and marinated, or things that are just kind of
raw. So you grill first and then marinate?
Yeah, something I like to do with vegetables, just because a lot of vegetables, fall apart on the grill, or they might stick before you kind of cook it all the way through, or burn, for instance, like eggplant. What I'll do a lot is grill my eggplant, I'll marinate it, I'll throw it on the grill. I'll get like a nice, good, like kind of smokiness from the grill, even though it's just gas, but you still pick up the char. And then what I'll do is I'll pull it off, I'll put it in a bowl, and then I'll hit it with some acid, like maybe like a light vinegar, like a white balsamic or like a red wine vinegar, olive oil, and then I'll just sort of like wrap that whole bowl in plastic wrap. And then I just kind of let it sit until I'm ready to eat. And what happens is the plastic wrap like creates steam in there, and it kind of finishes cooking the eggplant without the harshness and, pulling all the moisture out like the grill would do. Mm. So I do a lot with like zucchini. We hit a lot on the grill. Zucchini is a big one, different squashes.
Are there any unusual squashes or types of vegetables that you like to put in there just to shake things up?
I like okra a lot. I think it's kind of like a...
You grill okra?
Grill okra, yeah. It's an underrated vegetable. Tomatoes are great on the grill, like a nice good char on one side.
How do you grill a tomato, because they're so sloppy?
So you obviously wouldn't pick one that's super ripe. You would pick like a little bit underripe tomato or not super soft. Then what I do is I cut it horizontally and I kind of squeeze some of the seeds out, and that's going to get rid of some of your moisture, some of those seed pockets, and then just kind of get your grill nice and hot. And like Joe was saying earlier, I think the one thing people do is they move things on the grill too much, because it's kind of, they want to be like flipping everything and touching everything. But even for me, if I'm cooking a burger on the grill, I get the grill really hot, I put the burger on, and then I let it sit. And I won't really flip the burger until it's like 60 or 70% done. So really you're getting like a really nice char on one side, and then what I'll do is flip it, and then I'll finish cooking it briefly on that other side. But if you keep flipping it around, every time you flip it around, the moisture is getting drawn to the outside of the burger or whatever you're cooking, and it's creating steam on that grill surface.
And don't flatten the burger.
And don't flatten the burger, yeah.
Joe, what are your thoughts here? Don't flip it a lot?
It's funny. There's different schools as far as that goes, different camps. I know at Minetta Tavern here in New York City, they do it on a flat top, not a grill, so it is a little different, but they flip it constantly. That's their strategy, is they think that by constantly flipping it, they're keeping some moisture in. I don't know, to be honest with you. I do know that if you want to flatten your burger, do it before it goes on the grill or the flat top or the pan or anything like that. It's okay to do that. But once it's on there, you do not want to squeeze that thing, because then you really are. It's like a sponge. You're just squeezing all the water out of it, all the moisture out of it.
Let's get back to vegetables for just a moment. I guess doneness is probably in the taste of the beholder. Joe, I'm looking at one of your recipes, charred corn with compound cream cheese. You like to char your corn.
I like to char most stuff. I feel like if things are going on a grill, they need to have a char on them. Otherwise, there's no point of cooking them on the grill. You might as well put them in the oven. And I think certain vegetables, I learned this from my grandparents, they love burning things on purpose. So certain vegetables really take to getting a good char on them. I think broccoli and string beans and cauliflower and corn, the starchier, kind of denser vegetables like that, taste great when they're, you know, kind of a little carbonized. Not to the point where it's, you know, the entire thing is black, obviously. Little spots of burnt pieces add a nice complexity and a nice nuttiness, and rarely ever get bitter for some reason. And, I'm not sure why. It's probably from the sugars that are in the vegetables that kind of caramelize, and eventually, I'm sure if you go too long, it will develop some bitter flavors.
But, yeah, I was going to say, if it's bitter, is it burnt?
Well, I mean, if you're really, you know, covering the entire surface of whatever it is you're cooking in a black char, that's too much. But pieces of it, spots of that char throughout the vegetables, that's adding some great flavor to it. And corn works really well. And as those sugars in the corn caramelize, they kind of actually get a little sweeter, and they get a little chewy. So when you bite into the kernels on the cob after they've been directly on the fire, there's a little chew to it that develops from those sugars caramelizing.
So with this charred corn recipe with compound cream cheese, does the cream cheese take the place of butter?
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of a little play on like Mexican corn, where there's a little mayonnaise and cheese mixed together and usually seasoned. So we do this thing where we mix za'atar, which is a Middle Eastern like spice mixture, in with a cream cheese. The reason why you need something like cream cheese or mayonnaise or something like that is so the spice will stick to the corn. As Josh was saying earlier, that's probably another reason why he marinates his stuff after it comes off the grill. Vegetables, when they're in their raw state, really won't absorb seasoning or marinade very well. It's not like protein. So to do it afterwards makes much more sense, or to have something adhere to the corn or the vegetable that'll keep those seasonings on there. So that's kind of what the purpose of the cream cheese is. It also adds a nice little, little tang to the final product. But
sure.
Truth be told, it's kind of a glue for the spices to stick onto the corn.
Okay. So, well, and as with the fennel pollen, where do you find the za'atar?
Obviously, in any Middle Eastern store, you'll find it. But again, in a more gourmet-focused grocery store, in their spice section, you should be able to find za'atar. It's not that obscure of a spice mixture. It's a mixture of spices. It's sumac and it's sesame seed and a few different things in there. But it's fairly readily available. It might not be at every grocery store, but it's around. And I'm sure going online, you'll find tons of it.
Okay, let's get to some emails now. Francis says, I love grilling thick my steaks in the summer, a delicious fish with a very healthy population and an excellent fishing experience. She likes to marinate them in olive oil, salt, pepper, onion powder, some chopped garlic, a pinch of paprika, and a splash of red wine vinegar. Sounds good? And everything's probably right in the cupboard, right, Josh?
Everything sounds simple and delicious, yeah, for sure.
So do you fish sustainably? Do you avoid those creatures which are endangered?
I mean, at the restaurant or?
When you're out fishing, when you're looking for, what you're putting on the table at the restaurant.
I mean, at the restaurant, we focus on sustainable fish from the Northeast pretty much. Just for, we feature a lot of local vegetables and a lot of local meats. And for me, just as an experience for the diner, it doesn't make sense for me to fly a fish in. Even if it is sustainable, to sit in, a restaurant in Philadelphia that's serving you like the most local of meat and produce, to then serve like some kind of fish brought in from Alaska or Hawaii. What I try to do is find the more underappreciated fish or the sustainably sourced fish from anywhere from like, we try to stay from like North Carolina up to like Maine is kind of like our sweet spot. And we just try to find fish that are kind of reasonably priced and high quality and fish sustainably, and then kind of go from there.
And when you work with meat, you quite often use the whole animal. Why don't you get into that for us a bit?
Sure. I mean, my grandfather was a butcher. I spent a lot of time at Blue Holt Stone Barns where we dealt almost exclusively with whole animals. It's really just, you know, as a chef, gaining an understanding of using everything and kind of finding different cuts that you can't find readily available and kind of featuring those and giving people like a unique experience.
Such as?
I mean, lamb necks are like a great underappreciated meat. Just being able to break down the whole animal the way you want to break it down and kind of, you know, when you break down a pig, you can leave more meat on the spare ribs if you want to. It's kind of like creating a different cut, so to speak, than I could just getting, you know, a case of spare ribs from a, you know, a big producer. You can kind of tailor the cuts to the dish that I have in mind or kind of utilizing another part of the animal that necessarily doesn't get used in a certain way normally.
And what are you talking about there?
Well, like, for instance, you know, there's like little cuts and muscles from each animal that, you know, aren't necessarily featured in the grocery store. But when you have the whole animal in front of you, you can kind of carve out little pieces. So, you know, if we wanted to leave the pork belly on the bone, we could do that. If we want to, you know, make our rib chops longer and kind of like more dramatic, I have the ability to do that. And then also just different cuts. Like, for instance, like there's like a few muscles in the pork shoulder that are just like a really unique cut and kind of delicious, but for the most part are, you know, either cooked as a whole shoulder usually or kind of ground up for sausage. You know, we kind of pull those muscles out and it allows us to kind of give people unique experiences.
Okay, let's get back to barbecue, which is unique to each corner of the country, I guess. Joe, you say Texans say barbecue is beef. North Carolinians swear allegiance to pork. Texans think barbecue sauce is blasphemous. Kansas City worships its sticky, shiny glaze. So after investigating all this, Joe, how would you describe your technique?
Well, you know, our approach, because New York City and really the Northeast has not been historically a bastion of barbecue, we're afforded the luxury of not having rules to follow outside of following the traditional technique itself. So we can kind of do what we want, which is really nice and liberating. But I also wanted it to make sense in New York City and in the Northeast where we are. So I took a sort of Mediterranean approach to how and what we were going to do at barbecue, and that is using what's around us and using what is local and using the sort of common food vernacular that we in New York and in the Northeast have used for a long time. So pork belly, for example, is something that we started using very early on. Pork belly has been a thing in New York restaurants for 20 years in a you know, kind of, you know, fine dining sense. So we decided, and pork belly to me is a bit of a head scratcher with tradition, why it's not been used more in traditional barbecue. And the only thing I can come up with is that perhaps it all got turned into bacon. But it is such a great cut of meat for barbecuing, for smoking over a long period of time.
Well, and perhaps it's the name, too. I mean, most people, I'm guessing, shop in supermarkets, and you're used to looking at certain cuts of meat, and we're not looking at pig's feet and pork bellies and et cetera.
Perhaps. But even down south, you know, historically speaking, for hundreds of years, nobody's really barbecued pork belly. Mm. So, you know, there must have been, I mean, my guess is that it almost all of it got cured and turned into bacon. So pork belly was one thing, beef cheeks and pork cheeks, using Italian sausage from a local producer instead of, some other, you know, home style sausage that they would use down in Texas with, jalapeno peppers in it, for example. We wanted to go with something local. So we definitely took an approach that made sense for us and spoke directly to who we were going to be serving. And I think that, you know, New Yorkers, and not just in, you know, coming from fine dining, but we get tons of, Chinese and Koreans from Queens coming out eating pork belly and eating beef cheeks and loving it because they can't get stuff like that outside of, say, some restaurants in their home neighborhood.
So I was going to say, Joe, walk us through the barbecue process.
Barbecuing is really quite simple. As long as you have a cut of meat that is suitable for barbecuing, and that means high fat content and lots of connective tissue, lots of collagen that can break down and create, take trans, transform a really tough, chewy piece of meat into something really soft and wonderful and tender. And that takes a lot of collagen to make that happen and a lot of intramuscular fat. So when you get a cut like that, be it pork shoulder or brisket, then it's just a matter of cooking it at a pretty low temperature. Now, we cook at about 220 degrees on average. A couple of things go higher. Sometimes it goes a little lower. But that's really where our sweet spot is, at about 220 degrees. And then cooking it long enough, and this is really the key, and this is something that both trained chefs and home cooks have a hard time with when it comes to barbecuing for the first time, is the meat is done when it's done. It's not done when it reaches temperature, because the temperature that meat would be done at is much lower than the temperature that collagen I was speaking about breaks down at. So it needs to go further to break down that collagen and really liquefy that collagen internally in the meat. So it really comes down to learning from a bit of trial and error and poking and prodding and pulling at your protein in the smoker to get a sense of when it truly is done. And that's where, if there's any real, you know, kind of art in it, that's where it comes in, is knowing the perfect point that your barbecue is at the best state of doneness without being overcooked and dry.
And Joe, quickly before you get to the break, dry rub versus barbecue sauce for you.
You know, I'm a dry rub guy, generally speaking, but I don't have a disdain for barbecue sauce by any means. And I think barbecue sauce is best on the side, used as like a bit of a dip. You know, just kind of lightly touching the meat to some barbecue sauce, just to give it some accent. I don't have a problem with meat being barbecued with sauce in a wet style. Generally, what I do have a problem is when you order barbecue somewhere, when you get it and it comes slathered in sauce after it's come out of the smoker.
Okay, Joe Carroll is chef and owner of Feta Sal Restaurant. Josh Lawler is with us as well. He's chef owner of Farm and the Fisherman. We're back in just a moment here on Radio Times. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 888-477-9499. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. And our guests this hour are Joe Carroll, chef and owner of Feta Sal Restaurant and a barbecue master, and Josh Lawler, chef owner of Farm and the Fisherman. And Josh, why don't we get into the kitchen garden?
Mm-hmm.
As some of us who have them know, it can really make a difference in your summer menu. What are some must-haves if you're going to make the attempt to plant?
I have a pretty extensive garden at my house. What I like to plant really is stuff that I can't find at markets readily available, or stuff that's like super expensive. You know, like to grow something that's hard to find, or you know, might be, you know, expensive, like an herb or a flower, and then just sort of be able to use it at, you know, at leisure as much as you want. And you know, hard to find stuff. Like I stay away from like corn, for instance, just because it's, you know, farmers
grow. It's abundant.
It's abundant, and they're better growing it than I am. But I will grow like tomatoes that are hard to find, or you know, eggplants, kind of heirloom variety of eggplants that are interesting. I have like a really big herb garden. I just love a lot of fresh herbs. They're kind of hard to find, like lemon balm and whatnot.
I was going to say, what's in your herb garden?
I mean, I have lavender, lemon balm. I really like mints or two are fantastic, mm-hmm. like chocolate mints.
And you cook with the lavender?
I love lavender and chicken, actually. Yeah. Huh. Purple sage is another big one. You know, and a lot of them are perennials, anise, hyssop, and they come back year after year and they kind of look great. And then as far as when you have the you have the plants at your house, you have the ability to kind of harvest things at different times. So for instance, if you grow a beautiful like heirloom zucchini, you know, at different stages you can harvest the plant at different times and eat it. So if you can have the blossoms. You know, you have the baby zucchini with the blossom is like an interesting, you know, ingredient. And then you kind of forget about it for a couple of days, you get full-size zucchini. But like all along the growth process, you can harvest the plant and use it in different ways, which is kind of, you know, a luxury of having something in your backyard.
And so do you use your kitchen garden for your restaurant?
I'll tend to, yeah, for like edible flowers and whatnot. You know, just for me, it's, you know, one thing I'll kind of, you know, I'll look at, someone will bring me like a quart of flowers and they want, you know, a certain amount of money for it, and it'll just drive me crazy when I know I can grow it myself.
Which type of flowers?
I mean, we'll do Johnny Jump Ups, like more obscure ones like pineapple sage. You know, I use like the lavender. different, you know, different like kind of mints and thymes flower at different times, like chai flowers are beautiful.
And so how do you use those on a dish? Do you use it as just as a decoration, an edible decoration, or does it, it's supposed to complement the flavor of the food?
Yeah, so like herbs kind of to transfer the flavor, I do like two things. One is like obviously you could like chop it up and put it right into the dish. But other ones are kind of harder and, you know, not as nice on the palate. So what I'll do is either draw the flavor out with like a vinegar or like a simple syrup with sugar. So for instance, like lemon balm, it's kind of like a little rough. And if I chop that up, it, you know, wouldn't be the most pleasurable sensation in your mouth. So what I'll do is I'll get a lot of lemon balm and then I'll make like a really light simple syrup with sugar and water.
How do you do that?
I just boil half water and half sugar. It's super easy. And then I'll do that and I'll pour that over the herb. And sugar just really transfers flavors well. So then what you have is this beautiful lemon balm syrup that I can then add to like vinaigrettes or broths or whatever I'm kind of using at the restaurant. Or I'll make a vinegar out of it and I'll just take like a really light vinegar, like a nice white balsamic I'll buy that's, you know, very reasonable. And I'll just pour that over the herbs and kind of let it steep for like a month or so. Like lemon verbena makes like a beautiful vinegar. So then I can transfer that lemon verbena flavor that's from like a harsh kind of tough plant and I can put it right into like a vinaigrette or like finish a fish with it. Like we just use a lot of acids at the restaurant. I think it's one thing that separates, you know, home cook from professional cooking.
Okay, I'm going to ask you this question, Josh, and then I'll ask the same of you, Joe. So Memorial Day is just ahead. What is the perfect Memorial Day dinner menu in your mind? Considering your fast-paced lifestyle, Josh.
I mean, what we'll probably have is chicken wings, like really slowly cooked on the grill, actually. My wife cooks them about once a week, and it's probably my favorite thing to eat. And we'll do them really, start them off really hard on the grill with like a light rub on it. And then
what type of a rub?
We'll do whatever's around, but we like kind of like the barbecue stuff. Like, you know, we buy different rubs, we make different rubs. It's nothing hard and fast. And then we'll just lower the heat and let them cook like maybe for an hour till they're super crispy. And then that, a loaf of bread, and then probably like a vegetable salad or whatever we kind of have around, throw it on the grill or just lightly marinate it.
And where do you get your bread?
Bread, we just find like a really great loaf wherever we're kind of at a bakery at that time. We like, you know, I like a crusty, like kind of Italian loaf or like a sourdough. And I just like to kind of like mop up like my vinaigrettes with it and all the kind of juices that come out from the meats and the vegetables.
And Joe Carroll?
You know, I tend to think, you know, on American holidays, going with beef, it's like probably the most American protein. So a great steak. I love ribeyes or a really great burger that, you know, preferably you grind yourself or you have a butcher grind for you.
What do you do to your burgers?
You know, not much. I tend to generally, when I'm making burgers, I love making them in a frying pan or a flat top. But if I'm grilling burgers, and when I do that in a frying pan or a flat top, I do like to do them very thinly and almost have them steam. But the opposite is true when I'm grilling. I tend to go much thicker with burgers and do very much what Josh was saying. Get a nice hard crust on the outside and then let it cook slowly to bring the interior up to whatever temperature you desire.
And so what would you serve with those burgers?
You know, just I love potato rolls. I love the squishiness of potato rolls. So probably just on a potato roll and then, you know, a bunch of kind of little condiments and contorno for people to add on if they like. I generally like my burgers pretty naked, maybe some cheese, and that's about it. But I know some people love, you know, lettuce and onions and tomatoes and all that kind of stuff. So I would put all that stuff on the side for people to just put whatever they wanted on. I love doing roasted peppers too, bell peppers.
And we are not turning our noses up at hot dogs here this hour. You like hot dogs.
I'm from Jersey, man. I love hot dogs. Are you kidding me?
But you skin your hot dogs.
Again, it depends what I'm doing with it, you know. So if I'm boiling hot dogs, I love skinned hot dogs, you know, hot dogs with skins on it, the sort of, you know, soubrette style. But again, coming from Jersey, there's a great New Jersey tradition of deep frying hot dogs. And in that case, you usually want to go skinless so they don't kind of explode in your oil. But on the grill, you can really go either way. I think skinless work a little better on the grill, too, because they won't split on you as well or as much.
Okay, adult beverages, wines that you prefer with summer meals, Josh?
I'm a big, crisp kind of white guy in the summer, or like we'll open a rosé. We're also kind of big beer drinkers, so I'll do a lot of light beers in the summer, like Hefeweizens. And
again, do you look for the local brewer?
For beer, I tend to, mostly because I kind of grab it from the tavern in Cherry Hill, which we feature a lot of New Jersey brews. But, yeah, I mean, local's generally great. It's interesting. I don't limit myself to it, though. I'll try some West Coast stuff. We also just like a really big, like, ice-cold pitcher of margaritas with tons of citrus and tons of herbs in it. It's great, too.
And what do you put what sort of herbs do you put in there?
Herbs? I love, like, one of the other things I love is, like, any lemon-based herb. Because what I like is you know, like lemon balm or lemon thyme or lemon verbena, it like has that bright citrus flavor without necessarily adding the citrus acidity, which I don't necessarily always want. So we'll like kind of like muddle in like, you know, like a big handful of a lemon verbena from the garden.
And Joe, you say if you're doing barbecue, save the fine whiskey for after the meal?
No question. Yeah. You know, I love whiskey and we have quite an intense whiskey program at Fête de Sal, but I don't think it really goes terribly well with the food itself. You know, whiskey is high alcohol, which brings a lot of heat to it. A lot of times in barbecue, there's already some kind of spicy heat component in the meat itself that just gets amplified when you drink alcohol. So I love cider with barbecue, and an American cider at that, because there's usually a little bit of residual sugar left in American ciders, which go a long way to balance out any heat from spice. But there's a nice acidity that cuts through the richness. And generally, and we have a pretty serious wine program at my other restaurant, St. Anselm, which is, you know, very grill forward. But again, I would, you know, not that I wouldn't recommend wine all the time with barbecue, but there's very few wines I would recommend with barbecue.
Okay.
Mostly because the barbecue will just clobber them.
Just have this one quick question, too. It's kind of an aside, but when you are purchasing from local sustainable producers, it's pricier.
It's pricier.
So if you're on a family budget, how do you work that into the budget if you want to head in that direction?
I mean, I think it's actually, you know, local sustainable meat is definitely more expensive than commodity meat. There's no question about it. But I think it lends to like a healthier style of eating, because if you have a certain amount set aside per meal and you want a full meal with an array of products, and the meat costs more, your protein costs more, what you're going to have to do is buy less meat and more vegetables, which I just think is like a great way to eat. And it's kind of the way we need to move forward with eating. It's you buy good quality stuff, you buy less of it, you enjoy it more because you don't eat as much of it. And you can also buy the cheaper cuts, which are great cuts, like the cheaper, like the pork shoulder. And what you end up with is a meal that's got a ton of vegetables, vegetable-focused, and then you have less meat, which is healthier, and you're only supporting people that are raising meat sustainably and naturally.
Joe, your thoughts?
You know, we spend less on food than any other developed nation. So to spend a little bit more on the food we're eating and maybe a little bit less on some other things that we do, or a little less on junk food or things like that, I think is well worth it. And I know that it can get a little pricey, but, you know, usually we're not talking 3-4 times the price of commodity meats. We're talking just a dollar or three a pound more. It's so worth it on so many levels. It's just so much better for you. It's so much more flavorful. And like Josh said, you know, at the end of the day, too, you're supporting family farmers. You're kind of, you know, helping things across the board. Commodity factory farms, aside from producing terrible meat, do a lot of damage to the environment. There's so much negativity that comes from factory farming. So to support these family farmers goes such a long way. And, you know, that's on top of, you know, the higher quality meat you're getting and the fact that you're not eating antibiotics and hormones and steroids and all this other junk.
Mm. Okay, back to recipes. Josh, soup doesn't generally come to mind when we think of summer, but we've got a recipe of yours called chilled golden tomato and peach porridge.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, why use golden tomatoes? And secondly, there's also a hot pepper thrown in there. So how do all those flavors play off each other?
So, I mean, one of the things with cooking in the summer is things that grow together tend to taste well together. And really this kind of was a product of I had a ton of golden tomatoes at the time, and peaches were just at the peak of the season. And tomatoes and peach just are like a classic combination. Grilled peaches add like great flavor to like a tomato salad. You know, they extract liquid that creates like a wonderful broth. So we kind of did this like rough yellow tomato and peach porridge right at the peak of the season. Kind of left it kind of rough and rustic, almost like a really rough gazpacho kind of thing, but more chunky. And then the hot pepper just kind of cuts the, you know, the sweetness of the peach. And we add a little bit of hot salami there to kind of like add some depth of flavor. So it's not just, you know, using it to kind of accent the flavors of the peach and the tomato, the sweetness and the acidity, and kind of bringing that out. And heat's a great way to do that.
And by the way, if you're interested, you can find this recipe at our website, facebook.com at WHYY or /WHYY Radio Times. Hey, as we're wrapping the hour up, I'd like to get to desserts, because most of us, let's face it, look for dessert at the end of the meal. A simple, elegant dessert using fresh fruit. What comes off the top of your head, Josh?
A little bit of sugar on some like beautiful strawberries right now are amazing. That with like whipped cream or just over ice cream is kind of how we do it at my house.
Simple. What kind of sugar?
I'll just
powdered?
Nah, we would do like a we're big opponents of sugar in the raw at our house.
And Joe?
I'm sorry. Unfortunately, I was on a phone that died, so I missed part of the conversation. I'm back on now.
Welcome back. We didn't even know you were gone. we're talking just about, you know, off the top of your head, because most of us look for dessert at the end of a meal, a simple dessert using the fresh fruits that are available right now. What would you do?
Well, I know Josh had mentioned peaches, which go really well on grills. You know, no question. They hold up well. They caramelize really greatly on a grill. You know, most stone fruit does if it's not overripe, and that's the key, I think, is keeping the fruit from being mushy. Beyond that, I love doing, and we for some reason didn't include it in the book, but I love grilling like sandwiches with some sweeter components, whether it's like some great dark chocolate and peanut butter, or some Nutella and stracchino cheese, and putting it on some really great bread and just getting it all melty on the inside and getting some nice grill marks on the outside.
What sort of flavor combination is that with the Nutella? What does that produce?
It's wonderful, because Nutella obviously brings the sweetness and the chocolatey component, but the stracchino brings this like real, you know, milky lactic thing, and also a bit of salinity, some nice saltiness to it.
Oh, and one more note too, while we're talking about grilling, you advocate making your own coals.
Well, yeah. So,
is it for everybody?
Well, we mean by that is not literally making like hardwood charcoal, which is okay. A pretty intricate process. What we're saying is by burning down hardwood to coals, and then using those coals to cook with, versus, you know, using just charcoal to begin with, which is really the way. Like, for example, if you're down in the Carolinas, that's how most of the barbecue is done there. It's done over hardwood coals, not the actual wood itself or hardwood charcoal. So, you know, there's a difference between charcoal and coals. Mm-hmm. Charcoal is wood that is basically burnt in an anaerobic environment without oxygen. And that's why it keeps its structure and density. Coals are just burnt down pieces of wood that are still, you know, embers glowing that contain a lot of heat.
And lightning.
You won't get that. smokiness, but you'll get that flavor of the grill.
Thanks, Joe. We're just about out of time, unfortunately. It was a pleasure. Joe is chef and owner of Fetisau Restaurant and author of Feeding the Fire. And Josh Lawler is the chef owner of Farm and the Fisherman. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And remember, if you have the chance, check out our Facebook page and podcast by visiting WHYY.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers are Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times. Thanks for joining us.